everyone. This is Cartoons to Castles,
the history behind the mouse and magic. I'm Melanie.
And I'm Jessica. We're best friends and Disney nerds who wanted to learn more about the history behind the Walt Disney Company's movies, shows, music, theme parks, and more, and share it all with you.
So thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy today's episode.
Welcome back, everyone. It is our final episode of 2020. I can't believe it.
Episode 11.
And I believe that this marks 5 months of Cartoons to Castles, which is super exciting. 5 months of shenanigans ensuing. Thank you guys so much.
I don't even remember when we started. I have no idea.
It was like July 15th.
Oh, yes. It was the month that Disneyland's anniversary.
Birthday.
Got
yes,
it.
Yes, that's how I remember it, because I remember Disneyland's birthday. But yeah, don't worry, guys. We will be back. In case you missed our mini episode last week, we will be back in 2021. We're just taking a little break for the holidays. This will be our last one, aside from our bonus episode for our Patreon subscribers.
Yes.
So, Melanie, you have a new review for us to read.
I do. And if you want to leave a review for the show, if you enjoy the show and want to say something nice, we always appreciate it just for that. But also, it helps us get visibility in Apple Podcast rankings. And it's also just fun for us to read these new reviews on the show. So we have a new one from Violet July 88. And the title is "So Much Fun and Magic. Jessica and Melanie are so fun to listen to, and I love all the fun Disney topics they dive into. I always look forward to each episode." That is so nice. Thank you so much, Violet July 88.
Thank you. Yes, and thank you guys again for those reviews. And while we take our break, if you have a moment to give us one of those reviews, that would really help us while we're, you know, reconvening for the holidays and getting ready for those January episodes.
Yeah.
And we also, you know, last we recorded, we launched our Patreon. And so we wanted to thank those of you guys who signed up or just supported and were excited for us having a Patreon. I know not everyone can become a patron, but just all the support is very much appreciated.
Yes.
Yeah. And we'll include a link to that in case you missed it. So that will be in the show notes, but it means so much that you guys have supported our work in our first 5 months. I've had a blast doing this with you, Melanie. We wanted to do this for so long.
it's been awesome. And our first bonus Patreon episode is up, and it was all about the 1990 sitcoms that filmed at Disney parks. So that was a real fun one.
Yes.
We talked for 3 hours.
Yes.
With our husbands about it. So it is a lot of fun. So if you become a Patreon, you will get access to that episode.
And we have a December one, TBD if it will be out when this episode is out, but if not, shortly thereafter.
Yes. And it's also a really fun topic.
Yes. So this week, Melanie, do you want to tell our listeners what we're going to be talking about?
Yes, we have a special holiday episode. It'll be our last episode of the year before we take a break for the holidays. And this week, we are so excited to talk about the making of one of our favorite holiday movies, The Muppet Christmas Carol. And we actually did a poll among our Patreon members with several holiday topics to choose from. And this is the one they picked, which we are actually totally thrilled about. But before we get into the episode, we want to take a break for just a minute to tell you about something new.
So we wanted to say a few words about our brand new sponsor for Cartoons to Castles.
Yay!
So actually, this is some very delicious news that we wanted to share with you guys. So we all know there are a ton of classic Disney snacks that are fan favorites, but there is one breakfast option that is a must whenever we go on a Disney vacation. The classic Mickey waffle.
Yes.
Recently, Melanie and I discovered you can actually make waffles at home using the same mix that they use in the parks to make Mickey waffles.
I was so excited when Jess told me about this mix. I was like, yes, yes, please, we will talk about waffles.
Yes.
golden malted pancake and waffle flour is the actual mix used at Disney parks, and for good reason. Golden Malted's patented ingredients and natural flavorings make the perfect crispy waffles, and they even have an entire line of syrups, mixes, and appliances so you can make Disney Parks quality waffles at home whenever you want.
Melanie and I recently tried out the mix, and when you make it at home, it tastes just like it does at Disneyland. Golden Malted's grid conditioner also works great as a non-stick spray, and I think when I used it, it may have been the first time that my waffles didn't stick to a waffle maker. So that was a great plus. And speaking of griddles, Golden Malted also has a waffle baker available on their site, which bakes waffles to fluffy golden brown perfection in just about 3 minutes. They also have other flavors such as pumpkin, and they even have gluten-free, and the gluten-free mix is also vegan.
And I got the pumpkin mix, and it is amazing. I'm so glad that I have waffles that have a pumpkin flavor. That's wonderful.
Yes.
And you can visit shop.goldenmalted.com or visit the link in our show notes and use code MOUSE20 for 20% off your order and get free shipping on orders over $49. And again, that code for 20% off is MOUSE20.
Now back to the show.
Jess, do you want to kick us off talking about this amazing movie?
Let's kick it off, baby.
All right.
So we are first going to talk about how the idea for the Muppet Christmas Carol came to be. So for those who don't know, this film, released in 1992, was directed by Brian Henson, who is Jim Henson's son. Now, his Jim Henson did pass away pretty suddenly in 1990. And after his father's passing, Brian Henson wanted to make a film that was different from the previous Muppet movies so that there wasn't such a direct comparison between him and his dad. He wanted, he wanted this to, you know, be his own while, of course, honoring his dad, but he didn't want people to compare Brian versus Jim. So Bill Haber, who was one of the founding agents of CAA, the Creative Artists Agency, like, you know, the main talent agency in Hollywood, came up with the idea of making a Muppet version of Christmas Carol. He called up Brian Henson and told him his suggestion. And this was in early 1991. It was almost 2 years before the film was theatrically released, because it was released in late 1992. So in early 1991, Bill Haber from the Creative Artists Agency called up Brian Henson, told him his idea, and Brian Henson was like, that's been done. Everyone's done a version of A Christmas Carol. It's been adapted so much. Like, he wasn't opposed to the idea. You know, he didn't want to turn it down out of a courtesy to Bill Haber, who was calling him up with this idea. But he, you know, he did express, like, I don't know how we can make our version stand out from what's already been done, you know? So a half hour later, after they hung up, you know, Brian Henson was thinking, like, how could we mix in the Muppets into this story? And, you know, maybe this could work. And a half hour later, after Henson last left it as, I'll think it over, Brian Haber called him back up and said that he sold the Charles Dickens Muppet movie. It was greenlit.
Oh, had a lot of time to think about it, huh?
Getting stuff done. You know, it's been said that I read in a lot of interviews that the grief of the loss of Jim Henson, the grief that Brian Henson was experiencing, as well as the puppeteers who had been working with Jim Henson since the original Muppet movie, many of them said, like, Jim Henson's passing really pushed them to outdo themselves for this film. Mm-hmm. So that really helped motivate and push them to do their best creatively, movie technology wise, puppeting wise. Now, initially, Brian Henson figured this would be approached as a wacky parody. After all, it's the Muppets. So he figured that that would be the approach to this film. However, the more he thought of it, the more he felt it should have more of a Charles Dickens true prose in the scenes. He felt previous versions of A Christmas Carol adaptations didn't have this. So he felt the best way to capture the wonderful way Charles Dickens describes scenes in the book would be to have Charles Dickens as a character. Mm-hmm. And he felt the previous versions did not capture that amazing prose that Charles Dickens is so famous for. So he thought, let's have it be a character. So now in 1989, to give a little background context, Disney and Henson had a merger. The Muppets weren't fully owned by Disney as in 2004. Like, this was a merger where Henson still had creative control over all things Muppets for the next 15 years. But Disney did produce and distribute The Muppet Christmas Carol. Now, as we know, Disney, particularly under the Michael Eisner and Jeffrey Katzenberg era, have lots of their own opinions that they want to share when making a movie. We've heard all sorts of stories.
That's a very polite way to put it.
Yeah.
They have lots of opinions.
They have lots of opinions when it comes to the creative direction or creative decisions of movies. Jeffrey Katzenberg, it was said, recognized the hardship on Brian regarding Jim's passing. So they were respectful of his vision for The Muppet Christmas Carol, even though it was considered a little unconventional how dark they were going with it and what a contrast they were having between the wacky parody of The Muppets and dark. It's guessed that maybe normally, like, you know, Michael or Jeffrey would have some opinions about this, but apparently they let Brian take the helm. They let him have creative control and kind of stepped back because they could tell, like, you know, this is deeper than just directing a movie. This is him directing the first Muppet movie after Jim's death. So they let him have that full creative control. Mm-hmm. Brian Henson said, quote unquote, Katzenberg could see that it was an emotionally fragile environment. He kept his production department away from me, end quote. And hence, or should I say Henson, we have the unique and perfectly crafted The Muppet Christmas Carol that we have known and loved for 28 years. Mm-hmm. And that's how the movie began.
All right. Well, I am going to talk about casting. Now, casting for something like The Muppet Christmas Carol is interesting because you're taking essentially comedic characters like the Muppets, like you said, and trying to fit them into this very serious, classic, heartfelt story. So they kind of had to approach it in a bit of a different way. So they were thinking about the role of Gonzo. So as you said, they added Charles Dickens to the movie as the narrator and cast the least likely character to play him, Gonzo. Rizzo the Rat also starred as his sarcastic sidekick, and they follow along with Scrooge's adventures throughout most of the film. Henson said that 95% of what Gonzo says in the movie is directly taken from the book. Dave Goles played the role of Gonzo. I'm not sure if I pronounced that right, but I think it's Dave Goles, as well as Robert Marley and several other voices in the movie. And Rizzo the Rat was played by Steve Whitmire, who also voiced Kermit the Frog in the role of Bob Cratchit. Whitmire said that Bob Cratchit was a natural fit for Kermit the Frog because of his caring nature. Now, Muppet Christmas Carol was going to be the first Muppet movie where Jim Henson didn't provide the voice of Kermit, and Whitmire was understandably super nervous about performing the role. He said, "I was taking over from Jim as Kermit, which was a little scary, as you might imagine. It was important not only to match Kermit's character, but also his voice. Jim and I don't sound exactly alike, and the night before we pre-recorded the songs, I had a lot of trouble getting to sleep, thinking, I really want this to be good. This means so much to everybody." Then he had a dream. Whitmire said, "I was in this building that was all white, and Jim was there. He comes over to me in a hurry to get somewhere quickly. I said to him, 'I'm really nervous about taking over Kermit.' He looked at me. Jim would do this thing where he would take one finger and put it on the bottom of his lip as he was thinking. He thought like this for a second and said, 'It'll pass,' and he walked away."
Whoa. I saw a headline when I was researching, but I didn't click it because, like, I knew this, the casting was your topic. But I saw one that said he got cast as Kermit from Jim Henson telling him in a dream. And I was like, what?
Well, he was already cast.
Okay, but that makes more sense than what the headline said when I glanced at.
But Whitmire did say that the experience felt more like a visit than a dream, and that he then felt confident through the rest of the filming process. So that seems like it was a very useful dream.
Yeah.
And I have to include one more quote from Whitmire because he had so many beautiful things to say about Kermit. He said, "On my best days, I have the sense that I'm channeling Jim in some way. We and Kermit all share a dualistic view on life where the good stuff and the bad stuff equals itself out. Kermit looks for equanimity in things. He sees the best in people and sees the worst in people and nurtures them beyond that without criticizing them. It's the way Jim was, and it's the way I've tried to operate in my own life as well. So I thought that was a really beautiful quote about Kermit, who's still one of my very favorite characters of all time. So moving on to one of the few humans in the movie, let's talk about Scrooge. As far as the vital role of Scrooge goes, several actors were said to be considered for the character early in the process. I wasn't sure if this was true, but it was rumored that American comedian George Carlin and English actors David Hemmings, Ron Moody, and David Warner were all considered for the role, but Michael Caine was the first and only actor to be officially offered the role, and you can absolutely see why. This is what Brian Henson had to say about Michael Caine and his portrayal of Scrooge. Quote, "When I met Michael Caine to talk about playing Scrooge, one of the first things he said was, 'I'm going to play this movie like I'm working with the Royal Shakespeare Company. I will never wink. I will never do anything Muppety. I am going to play Scrooge as if it is an utterly dramatic role and there are no puppets around me.' I said, 'Yes, bang on.' He was intimidating to start with, but he's a delight."
I love that.
Yeah, it really shows in his portrayal. Like, he plays it completely straight. All the way through. And I think the movie is better because of that.
I mean, Garrett and my husband and I were just talking about how we hands down think that Michael Caine is the best Ebenezer Scrooge there's ever. Yeah. He's so good.
I mean, this is kind of a local thing. A theater company near where we live called South Coast Repertory, before the pandemic, would do a version of A Christmas Carol every year. And Hal Landon Jr., who was also in the Bill and Ted movies, he would play Scrooge every year. And I think he and Michael Caine are neck and neck.
I never got to see that version.
Oh, it's so good. But he and Michael Caine are neck and neck for the best Scrooge. But yes, those two, I think, are my favorite Scrooges of all time. So as far as the other human characters go, Stephen McIntosh played Scrooge's charming nephew Fred, and Robin Weaver played Clara, Fred's wife. And as a side note, my daughter's name is Clara.
Yeah.
And I just want to give a shout out to the story for having a character named Clara who's not an old lady. I always feel bad when we're watching a movie and they're like, "Her name is Clara," and she's like this old crone. I'm like, good.
Well, it's a very Christmassy name, apparently, because the Nutcracker, it is. Too.
It is very Christmassy. That's where it came from. So anyway, and another important non-Muppet character is Belle, Scrooge's former fiance. She was played by English stage actress Meredith Braun, who also starred in Les Miserables and Phantom of the Opera on London's West End and performed the song When Love Is Gone in the movie. The song was eventually cut, which I will be talking more about later in length. So
I can't wait.
Yeah. Brian Henson said that Braun performed the song at her audition and that he and the movie's songwriter, Paul Williams, quote, "just sort of melted and fell in love with her. She sang it beautifully. There was never a reason to even do a second take with her." A little story from me and Jess. Our friend Miley has told us that her boyfriend Leonard absolutely refuses to watch any version of this movie that doesn't have this song in it. And a lot of fans feel the same way. So later on when I talk about the music, I'll tell you all why this song was eventually cut. For now, still on the subject of casting, the casting of the other Muppets feels very natural. Miss Piggy is, of course, Mrs. Cratchit, Kermit's wife. Robin the Frog is Tiny Tim, and the curmudgeonly Statler and Waldorf are the first ghosts seen by Scrooge, Jacob and Robert Marley. Marley is just one character in the book, but having two Marleys works perfectly for the script since we can totally see Statler and Waldorf as regretful misers, right?
Yeah, miserable misers.
Yeah, miserable misers.
They're the definition of that. It's great.
In other genius casting, Fozzie Bear was, of course, cast as Fezziwig, or known as Fozziwig in this movie, who is Scrooge's former boss at the Rubber Chicken Factory. I love that little that little joke. It's so cute. This character is important because he provides a stark contrast to Scrooge with his generosity and kindness as an employer. The Muppets playing the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future were original to the movie, and I think, Jess, you might be talking about how some of the effects of these characters were made in your next segment. So why don't you go ahead and take us into how the movie was made.
I have lots of fun facts about all those amazing special effects. Like, bear in mind, this was 1992. If this was a Muppet movie that was released today, I don't think it would feel archaic at all in terms of technology. Like, it holds up. It's amazing. So, opening scene. First off, before I go into this, I just have to say, obviously, I appreciate CGI and CGI artists, and they have their time and their place, but oh my gosh, do I love real sets and practical effects. I just love them so much, and I love that this movie's filled with them. But at the opening scene, we have the opening credits of a foggy sky and lots of little houses and buildings, a little Dickensian town. And Brian Henson said that these models that we're panning over are actually 3 feet tall. 3 feet tall models. They're all real models. And they have a camera moving backwards across the set. And he didn't say how big it was, but he said in the DVD commentary that it was humongous. I mean, when you watch the opening credits, that opening scroll is huge. I can't imagine how many of those 3 foot buildings they had to have in the studio. And you'll see the clouds kind of look like they're jumping. And that's because they used smoke, a smoke machine for the clouds. And they had to film very slowly as they were panning over the buildings and be very careful going over the buildings. So it was, the smoke was going fast. The camera was going in slow-mo. So it looks a little jumpy. If you look very close. So this the set was at Shepherding Studios in London. And obviously, as I mentioned, they use lots of forced perspective buildings. And in the opening, when we first see Scrooge's entrance, there's Muppets on either side of Scrooge, and we see Scrooge's legs walking forward before we see the reveal of Michael Caine as Scrooge. He's actually walking on a 2 foot wide plank of wood he's walking through there, because where you have people in the movie, you have to have a floor. Where you have Muppets in the movie, you can't have a floor because there needs to be people underneath the Muppets operating them. So as he's making his entrance, his super dramatic entrance, where he is like full on in character Scrooge, on either side of him, there were two trenches, basically, with puppeteers operating all the Muppets we see at his feet. And he's having to walk on a tiny plank of wood. And Brian Henson said this is normally a very difficult thing for actors in Muppet movies to get used to, because it does feel like you're going to fall because it's very narrow. And they're constantly like adding, and like sometimes the floor has to be moving and rotating. So he was saying like it is a very tricky thing for actors. And he said Michael Caine actually said that it was quite fun and had and he said that he had no problem getting used to it. He said he just went right in, had no problem adjusting to this weird way of having to act and walk. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting to think about, because you don't really think about, oh, there has to be like a divot or a trench here, so where there's a Muppet and then not where the person is.
That's a pro right there.
Exactly. So in after all, there's only one more sleep till Christmas. This is such a small thing, but I thought this was really cool, so I wanted to share. You know, they're all wrapping up and leaving for work, and Kermit blows out a candle, and Brian Henson said that it's little things like that that you don't really think about as, wow, look at that special effect.
Oh, yes.
Those little things are important, because those little things that you don't think about are really what make the Muppets feel real. Because if they didn't do those little things, it would feel like a puppet. So he said they have to add those little touches in so they feel real, but it's not supposed to be something you think about. It's just, you know, it makes them feel more natural.
I never thought about that, because Kermit wouldn't be able to blow out a candle because he's a puppet. But I'd never thought about it.
They had to have a person behind Kermit, like crouched down with a little air gun, shooting a little puff of air at the candle. But he said they have to time it, because they have to have the person, since he's behind Kermit, they have to have the person with the air gun set off the air gun just a beat before Kermit actually blows it. Because it's going to take a little longer for that air to blow out the candle than it would for Kermit, since he's closer.
Oh my God.
So they had to time it perfectly. And I'm just like, whoa, this is why the Muppets feel real. I thought that was amazing.
So, wait, Jess?
Yes.
They are.
Melanie?
Excuse me?
Forget what I said. They're real, okay? So Marley and Marley, they are, Statler and Waldorf, as Melanie mentioned, are the ghosts of Marley and Marley in this scene. And how they did that was they made the puppets white, or they powdered them down excessively to make them almost completely white. And they shot them against a sheet of black velvet, and the puppeteers behind them, puppeteering them, were wearing all black. And then they superimposed them over the set to make them look kind of see-through. So that's how that was done. Now I want to talk about the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and Christmas yet to come.
Please.
Those all have their own special little things. So the ghost of Christmas past, you know, we see her, she's very ethereal. They had the puppet actually in a tank of water. Originally, they were going to have her in a tank of baby oil because they thought it would give her a more glowy effect, but the baby oil was damaging the puppet too much. Switched it to water. So that puppet is shot in a tank of water to make her dress look like it's floating. And then had puppeteers with long rods reaching into the tank of water, maneuvering her. Brian Henson said that they couldn't shoot very long with that puppet. And if you think about it, that probably is the ghost of the three ghosts that you see the least. Mm-hmm. He just said it was very, you only have so much time to shoot in water before there's too much like damage done to the dress, and it's hard to get the shots. So he said, you know, they got the footage they needed, but they had to be quick and as concise as they could with the ghost of Christmas past.
Well, it looks really good.
Yes.
It looks really good.
And I'll mention before we move on to the ghost of Christmas present, when we go to Fozziwig's party, because I'm going in chronological order here. When we're at Fozziwig's party, we see at the party, there's lots of different levels of Muppets. There's like a table with Muppets eating at it, a table that's a couple feet higher than that, and then another table that's a couple feet higher than that. And he was saying that they had to have a set designer who knew how to build sets for Muppets. You can't just have any set designer come and build a set for the Muppets. It has to be someone experienced in creating sets for the Muppets or puppeteering, because when you have a ton of Muppets on screen at once, you need levels, or else everyone's going to be way down at the bottom of the screen because you can only shoot from the waist up.
Right.
They had to have those levels so that they could have lots of Muppets on screen and fill the screen rather than just be way down at the bottom of the screen. So we will go to the ghost of Christmas present, the jolliest of ghosts. So he was originally meant to be huge throughout. You know, when he first enters the scene, he's crouching down. He's taller than the ceiling. He's very big and larger than life. He was meant to be this big throughout the whole time because that's how it is in the original Charles Dickens novel. But that was going to be a logistical nightmare.
Oh,
pretty much. So the puppet is actually only 6 feet tall. Even in the scenes where he's humongous, it's still that same 6 foot tall puppet. And, you know, using force perspective and all those fun tricks, he's composited in the shot to look bigger than he is. But it was still very hard to shoot that and shoot with Scrooge interacting with him. So that they made him his normal 6 feet, 6 foot height as soon as possible, because it was a lot of work to make him the larger than 6 foot height. So there is an actor inside of the Ghost of Christmas Present costume. And then there's a puppeteer next to the cameraman who's operating his facial movements, which my husband wanted me to point out that this is how they did the live action Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movie.
Thanks, Garrett.
So there you go. So the same actor who plays Christmas Present also plays Christmas Yet to Come. As you could see, they're both very tall. So it makes sense that that was the same actor. And this time, obviously, there's no one off camera operating his facial movements because he doesn't have any facial
movements.
He doesn't have a face. But he has very long arms and long fingers. So the actor inside actually has mechanical hands that he operates with his own hands within the costume.
Very
cool. That's how that worked. So when we're with the Ghost of Christmas Present, we go to a time where Scrooge sees his future after his death, and we see three or four Muppet pigs standing with umbrellas in the rain, talking about Scrooge. And Brian Henson was saying they had to just keep going to these incredibly dark places in the film because they needed the ending to be so joyous. And for it to be so joyous, you need to go to really dark places for it to feel like an overwhelming sense of joy at the end. So he said, you know, at the end, it's snowing, it's Christmas. So he said, on this Christmas day, when he goes to a Christmas day with the Ghost of Christmas Yet to Come, let's have it be raining.
Oh.
Let's have it be raining.
I never thought about that.
That's not a very jolly Christmas. I mean, it would be in Southern California, but in this Dickensian town, it's not. And they were saying that Muppets in the Rain is very, very hard.
Yeah.
The puppeteers need at all times, this isn't just in the rain, this is always, the puppeteers need to be watching monitors to see what's around them. And having those monitors involves having a lot of volts. And so they were saying, oh, like, whenever there's rain, they need to set up the monitors, but it involves a ton of careful preparation to have Muppets in the rain, because obviously that's a big safety hazard. So it's a lot of logistics and safety prep and all that good stuff. Now, of course, I need to point out, I feel like even before I had the appreciation I do now of movie magic and Disney history, I feel like as a kid, Melanie, you love the Muppets even more than me. How did you feel when you saw Kermit's like full body walking, like head to feet? We see his feet. We see his full body walking. That's unusual.
I mean, anytime they did that on the Muppets, like when they did that or when they're riding the bicycles and, I forget what movie it is. Take away my Muppet fan card. But, you know, anytime they would do a full body shot, I was just amazed by that. And it's such a cute moment with him and Tiny Tim. It just makes it all the better that they're the only ones you see and you see their full bodies. It's so cool.
Well, this was done using 10 puppeteers. Actually, once I read this, if you go back and watch this scene, you can tell if you look super closely, but you know, he's walking on snow. They had a drum rotating beneath his feet that was like making his feet look like they were walking, and you could kind of see it if you look super closely. So that's fun. It's only if you're looking, you know, you could kind of tell. And then behind that, behind him was a blue screen with the puppeteer standing by the blue screen operating his limbs and his mouth. And then in post-production, they inserted the London Holmes in place of the blue screen. Cool. So that's how they did that. It took 10 people. And then we reach the end of the film where we see the Dickensian town again. We're panning back over the Dickensian town and the sky. That's that same 3-foot model Dickensian village. And then those jumpy smoke machine clouds.
Woo!
There we go.
So next, now that we've talked about the special effects in the movie, we are talking about the music. Now, there's a lot to say about the music. I will start with talking about Paul Williams. Paul Williams wrote the brilliant music for this movie, and back in the 1970s, he was known for writing hits for The Carpenters, Three Dog Night, and Barbara Streisand, even more than that. But Muppet fans know him for writing Kermit the Frog's song Rainbow Connection from the Muppet Movie, which I personally cannot listen to without crying. It's a real problem. In fact, you can see Paul Williams on the Muppet Movie episode of Prop Culture on Disney Plus, where they actually, spoiler alert, track down the actual banjo that Kermit used in the movie to sing Rainbow Connection, and they show it to Paul Williams, who kind of takes a trip down memory lane. So if you haven't seen it, it's a really good episode. But anyway, back to Muppet Christmas Carol. So after Williams' success in the 1970s, he actually spent most of the 1980s dealing with substance abuse and battling addiction. And at the age of 49, he finally reached his breaking point and entered himself into rehab. This isn't irrelevant. This is important to the story. On March 15th, 1990, he came out of recovery and felt like a new person. He said, quote, "The relief I felt was huge, and that I no longer woke up desperate to find what I needed, but the connectedness that I felt with the world around me was remarkable. All of a sudden, you have that feeling of being cared for. You have that feeling of belonging." But Williams honestly didn't think he would have a songwriting career to come back to. Then in 1990, 2 months after Williams got sober, Jim Henson passed away. So when it came time to choose a songwriter for The Muppet Christmas Carol, Brian Henson thought of Williams. Henson said he always felt the Muppet movie had the best music of any Muppet production, and I would not argue with that, and wanted Williams for the job. He was told the songwriter was struggling with addiction, but Henson said, let's just give him a call. And I'm going to quote Williams directly for this next section because what he had to say about his work on this movie was so insightful. He said, quote, when I got sober, the career I thought I had was pretty much gone. I just fell in love with recovery. I felt like that's all I wanted to do, and I didn't know if I was ever going to write music again. And then I was asked to write the songs for The Muppet Christmas Carol. Every now and then, the universe will line up to do something at the right time in your life. I was longing to live life in a totally new way, one day at a time, trusting that what I needed was within me to get things done. And I'm sitting down to write these songs, and I'm writing about Scrooge, a man who's learning to live life in a whole new way, who's having a spiritual awakening. It's like, okay, now this is my inventory of dealing with where I am in my own life. So Williams basically poured his heart and soul into writing this music for the movie. I think anyone who has been moved by the movie is as much moved by the truths found in the story of A Christmas Carol as they are by the sort of redemptive arc that's reflected in the music as well. Arguably the most memorable songs in the movie are the cheerful One More Sleep Till Christmas, sung by Kermit, It Feels Like Christmas, sung by The Ghost of Christmas Present, Thankful Heart, sung by Scrooge, and of course, the breakup ballad, When Love Is Gone, sung by Scrooge's fiance, Belle.
When love is gone, when love is gone, the sweetest dream that you have ever known, when love is gone, when love is gone.
I mean, I'm just like feeling like warm and fuzzy with you just saying the song's titles because it's, yeah. It's just all the songs are so
I know.
Comforting. They're just so good.
Oh. You know, and I loved that it brought Paul Williams comfort too while he was writing them, like coming out of recovery and thinking you're never going to work again and then getting to work on A Muppet Christmas Carol. Like it's just. Yeah. All of his gratitude is just so clear in the songs. Like, I think that's what gives them their warmth and their poignancy. It's just, I didn't know this backstory till I started researching this, and I just thought that was so interesting.
Yeah.
So going back to When Love Is Gone, to kind of illustrate how important this song is to fans of this movie and how people keep asking about it almost 30 years after the movie was made, my husband was reading his most recent issue of Entertainment Weekly, and there was actually a little article in it about this song and why it was cut.
Oh!
Yeah, Entertainment Weekly is now monthly, but that's beside the point. But it was in this month's November 2020 issue that I was like, whoa, that is very timely. I just thought that was so interesting that all these years later, that exact topic came up in an entertainment magazine. So the story behind the song is that Williams and Henson wanted a love song in the movie, but it didn't really fit anywhere in the script. So they decided to do the opposite and have Williams write a ballad about love ending. As I mentioned before, Meredith Braun played Belle and was already an experienced musical performer at that point. But Michael Caine had never sung in a movie before and was very nervous about it. Henson said that Caine did need a lot of takes, but that Braun was very supportive of him in the recording studio. And I think, and a lot of people think, his inexperience as a singer wasn't an issue because...
No, not at all.
What comes through in his voice is Scrooge's overwhelming emotion, and that's what ultimately touches the audience's hearts. Like, it's not important that he's not hitting every note perfectly.
And it's not like he's a Broadway singer, but I mean, but it wasn't off tune either. It was just it was perfect.
It's the emotion is the most important part, and he gets that perfectly. And Henson said that the staging of the scene between Belle and Scrooge was very different from the rest of the movie. The production design included imagery of dead trees and muted sort of autumnal colors to reflect the ending of the relationship. As Scrooge approaches Belle, you'll notice she keeps walking away, and the song captures that feeling of being in love with someone but knowing you have to leave because they don't value you the way you deserve. And the song also provided important backstory and character development for Scrooge. But as the story goes, Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was in charge of Disney's live action features at the time, had the song cut from the film. He felt kids would be bored by the song. I mean, that's a good point, but, you know, kids get bored when there's any lull in the action.
He almost stepped back, except for that song.
Yeah, exactly. Almost.
Why does Jeffrey Katzenberg always want to cut the emotional songs?
Like, I don't know.
Kids don't need everything to be fun and fluffy. Kids can understand emotion.
Yeah, I mean, right. Yes. Yeah.
Anyway, your
rage is felt by a lot of people, understandably. So he felt the kids would, you know, not be into the song. And so in the theatrical release of the movie, the dialogue proceeds as normal up to the song, then cuts to Belle walking away with Gonzo, Rizzo, and Scrooge in tears. And if you've never seen the song in the movie, the moment works okay. But once you've seen the movie with the song intact, the cut feels super jarring. You're like, wait, why are they sobbing right now? And it's because there is supposed to be this beautiful ballad and this journey we've all just gone through of Scrooge reliving losing Belle. And another issue that arises with the song being cut is that the score morphs into When Love is Found at the end of the film, just as Scrooge is beginning to learn how to keep Christmas in his heart and show kindness to others. And when it's contrasted to the way that melody was used earlier in the film, it's such a moving way to show how far Scrooge has come in his outlook on life.
Well, I met someone who touched my soul and made my world brand new. There's part of me, a place inside, that now belongs to you. The love we found, the love we found, we carry with us, so we're never quite alone.
So personally, my family had a VHS copy of the movie when I was younger, which we watched every year at Christmas time, and it included this song. So I totally understand why fans are so attached to it.
Now, I don't know if you know off the top of your head, but are there any versions that have it currently?
So as I can't hold too many details in my head at one time, I got a little confused about which versions did and didn't have it. The song was not included on some of the DVD and Blu-ray versions of the movie. I believe it was included on a 20th anniversary home release of the movie, but that is out of print.
I know for that one, they have two different, like when you put in the DVD, they have, you can watch the theatrical or the extended.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Well, that one I believe is out of print now, and it isn't included on the Disney Plus version. So, Brian Henson actually said that the original print of the song has been lost, if I'm understanding this correctly, but the Disney is currently looking for it. So
hey, maybe we need to call up Randy.
I know, Randy Thornton,
the finder of Disney music history.
Yeah, he's good at finding historical pieces. So I'm not sure what the future holds for this song, but if you want to watch it, it's out there. Just do a little Googling. And it's also on the movie soundtrack, so you can listen to it there as well. Other songs were cut from the movie. They were Room in Your Heart, which was sung by Dr. Bunsen Honeydew and his assistant Beaker, who are asking Scrooge to make donations to the poor. And then Sam the Eagle also had a song. He played young Scrooge's school headmaster and sang a song called Chairman of the Board. Both songs were recorded but didn't end up being filmed because they didn't advance the story enough. But you can hear these songs on the movie soundtrack if you're curious. To wrap up my segment about the music, I just wanted to share this quote from Muppet living legend Frank Oz. When talking about Paul Williams, he said, "I think it's his simplicity and his heart and purity. That's where it came from for Jim Henson, is the purity of intent, the purity of character. Not being afraid of sweetness, not pejorative sweetness, but real, actual, valuable sweetness. Jim was that, and Paul is too. They're able to be sweet without being saccharine. Jim hated being cute and hated saccharine. He hated faux sentimentality. What we got from Paul was exactly the reverse of that, exactly what Jim wanted. He and Jim somehow just connected. They just did. I don't know how many times he worked with Paul, but every time it always felt like he was part of the family." I thought that was a nice quote to wrap up. I absolutely love Paul Williams' music, so I thought that was a beautiful quote. So, Jess, can you tell us a bit about the audience and critical reaction to the movie?
Yeah, so aside, of course, from the long-standing love of this film, like, I think we would all agree this is like everyone would consider this a classic. It's loved by so many people. So it had a budget of $12 million and it actually made more than they expected, $27.3 million, which I read adjusted for inflation, that would be $59.9 million. So it clearly wasn't a flop, but it wasn't off the charts either. It was like, you know, it was a modest success, but I do feel like those numbers are pretty good considering it also had to compete at the same time at the box office simultaneously with Home Alone 2 and Aladdin.
Oh, my goodness. What? Both of those? Okay.
Both of those at the same time. I'm like, that's a lot of competition.
Yeah. Families had a lot of options that season.
I know. And all three of those are obviously classics. So that's
And I saw good. All three of them in the theater that year.
I think of those, I only saw Aladdin in the theaters, but it was so long ago. It's one of my earliest theater memories was seeing Aladdin, and I don't know why, but all I remember from the actual in-theater experience was the, "Still I think he's rather tasty." I only vividly remember watching that part of the theater.
That classic line.
Not the genie, not A Whole New World. That's what I remember. I mean, obviously, I've seen the movie many a time now, but for some reason, that's all I vividly remember seeing on the big screen.
You know what I remember from watching Home Alone 2 is what? My dad laughing so hard at the movie that I was embarrassed and wanted to leave. He laughed so hard when the burglars are getting hurt that he was coughing. He was coughing, he was doubled over, and I was so embarrassed. I was like early teens, so I was like hiding my face and slouched down in the seat. Like I was like, can we just sleep? Anyway, back to Muppet Christmas Carol.
Yeah, I was just going to add, this is not Disney related, it's just young theater experience related that this memory unlocked. I remember seeing the Swan Princess in theaters, and I remember like, as a child, like I was on the verge, I wanted to leave and on the verge of having a panic attack because I can't remember if I saw it with my mom or my grandma. I don't remember, but she, whoever it was, had us bring in fruit snacks. Like she packed fruit snacks in her purse. And I was just like, we're not allowed to bring our own food in the theater. And I was like, I thought we were going to get kicked out. I was like, I don't know. I just was this is bad. I was like, this is very bad. And I was having a panic attack.
You were anyway. So scared. Wait, what movie was that?
The Swan Princess.
Oh, The Swan Princess. I thought you said This One Princess, and I was like, what movie is that?
Anyway, back to the topic we're talking about. So, so I guess critics hadn't been like head over heels over previous Muppet movies, but they were a little bit more receptive to this one. Again, it was more modest in the reviews. It wasn't praise across the board, but they didn't hate it either. Most people praised it for the songs and the technological marvel that it was, but they said the songs were great, there could have been more. Or, you know, some said this is a great way to tell a Dickensian story to children, while others thought this is going to bore children. But clearly none of that mattered because it's a classic and we all love it. So, you know, I talked about kind of how it did when it came out, but I was like, I want to better capture like why this is so dear to people. Why is it considered such a classic? But I thought I'm going to go to our Patreon Facebook group, and I thought I would ask why it is special to people, and I wanted to read some of the things that they said.
Okay.
So Miley and Joe said that they loved the song they cut out, which we just talked about.
Yes.
Yeah. They won't watch any version that doesn't include it. And they find the Muppets so comforting. And so it just makes sense naturally that they would be a part of Christmas. And they also love the costumes.
Oh, that's nice.
Joy said she feels this is Rizzo's greatest performance, and the comedy between him and Gonzo is so perfect. Yeah. I agree on both accounts.
I do.
Garrett, my husband, said it was the first Muppet movie he saw in theaters. He remembers being terrified of the Marley and Marley scene, particularly the Our Hearts Are Painted Black line for some reason. And the movie is his favorite adaptation of the story. It's uniquely angled for a Jim Henson film since the original story has a lot of lighthearted goofiness as well as actual scary parts, stuff that Henson does very well. I remember after seeing it, overhearing my parents talking about how good Michael Caine was, and I was thinking how I barely cared about him because he wasn't a Muppet. Now, of course, as an adult, I understand how great he is, and he is truly the best version of Scrooge.
Michael Caine, who cares? He's not a Muppet.
You're not a Muppet. Sophie says it's her favorite Christmas movie, and as cliche as it is, she loves the songs, especially It Feels Like Christmas, and also just typical Muppet stuff where they break character, like when Rizzo is just being Rizzo. Mm-hmm. And she said she feels like it feels like such a classic since it's such a great mixture of a well-known story like A Christmas Carol mixed with the Muppets, which makes it feel so special. And your parents said it's...
Oh, my mom.
Oh, your mom. It's, okay. It's the perfect Christmas movie and best version of Christmas Carol. How can you beat the combination of Muppets with Michael Caine as Ebenezer Scrooge? So, yeah, I just was like, hey, let me get some, like, they voted for this episode. So let me see what they have to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us, even if you didn't see it as a kid, I think you can recognize how good the movie is. I have some more tidbits if you want to hear some.
I would love some tidbits.
Okay, these are just random bits of kind of trivia or little stories that I thought were interesting, and they didn't really have a place in my segments, but I wanted to throw them in there. I just thought this was a beautiful quote from Dave Goles, who did the voices of Gonzo and Waldorf in the movie. And he absolutely loved it just simply as an audience member. He said, "I've never been able to watch Muppet Christmas Carol dry-eyed. The comedy deepens the emotion. It ambushes you. It remains my favorite film we've done by a good margin. It's such a powerful piece of literature, and to be able to do it with our goofy characters and make it work, it's a huge, satisfying success." I totally agree with that. Yeah, I love that. So this is just a little thing for like a little Easter egg. So I did not know this, but Michael Caine's real name is Maurice Micklewhite.
Micklewhite?
Now, Michael Caine sounds like the real name and Maurice Micklewhite sounds like the made up name, but that is not the case.
It reminds me of like The Office, like the Bale Schnickel or something. I was like, that sounds like... Yes. It sounds like a very fairy tale-ish name.
Yes, it sounds like if you were making up a name of a British actor, you would make up Maurice Micklewhite, but that's his real name. And so in the film's finale, there's a shop that is named Micklewhite's in the background of one of the scenes.
Cute.
So you have to keep your eyes open for that.
I love that.
And there's also something that fans got upset about. In the Christmas feast scene at the end, Scrooge's nephew Fred's wife, Clara, is not there.
Yeah.
She's not there. And everyone was like, what happened? Is it that she left him? Like, is he on the same fate as Scrooge? Like, is he headed toward a life without love? And it's not any of those things. The simple answer is that the actress playing her wasn't available to shoot that day. So it doesn't have any deep meaning. It's just that she wasn't available that day. So she's not in the scene. So this was a really, really sweet one. So in the musical number, One More Sleep Till Christmas, Bob Cratchit stops in the middle of the city street to look up at a shooting star overhead. And this gesture was an homage to the Muppet movie when Kermit sees a shooting star while he's stuck in the desert. And Brian Henson intended this as a tribute to his father, Jim Henson.
Aww.
Yeah, and it has shown up in a number of Muppet productions since, including Muppet Treasure Island, Kermit's Swamp Years, It's a Very Merry Muppet Christmas Movie, and The Muppets. So I thought that was a really sweet thing.
Oh my gosh!
Like, if any Muppets fans, if you didn't know that, watch out for the little shooting star in other Muppet movies. It's a tribute to Jim Henson.
I said at the beginning, like, they were saying, like, you know, his passing really pushed them to go above and beyond, and it just... shows, like, in just in all the little details. It's so good.
I know I've been quoting a lot, but so many people have so many insightful things to say about this movie. But this quote really just summed up why The Muppet Christmas Carol is so good to me. This is from Michael Newton from The Guardian, and he wrote, "In The Muppet Christmas Carol, one wonderful paradox is that Michael Caine as Scrooge is almost the only real human on screen, while the film concerns itself with what makes us humane." I thought that was so cool. It's just such a human story, and it's told all by Muppets, and it somehow works beautifully, and I just love that about this movie. So, yeah, it's been awesome talking about it with you.
Oh, you know what? You made me think of another little tidbit.
Oh, what?
This isn't like an insanely fun fact. It was just interesting and funny. When I was watching the DVD commentary for this, the director Brian Henson does, he said that when they did audience testing, which obviously they had children be part of that, since it's a family movie, he said that all the responses from the kids, almost all the responses from the kids, all said their favorite part was the same thing.
What was it?
It was something that they just threw in last minute in the opening song when there's the little mice and they go, "No cheeses for us, Mises." And he said that was just a random thing we threw in last minute to fill in that spot with no lyrics. And he said, and all the kids were saying, "I liked the mice."
But it's so cute, Jess.
Yeah.
They're such cute little puppets. But I'm just like,
it's so funny because that's always how it goes, where you could work so hard on something and it falls flat. Not saying the movie fell flat, but, you know, just in general. And then you could just do something just off the cuff and then everyone's like, "That's my favorite thing."
Yeah, the kids aren't like, "What I liked most was Scrooge's redemptive arc." Like, they're like, "I like the mice."
I just thought that was funny.
Yeah, well, it's a good moment.
I want to meet the kid who says their favorite thing is Scrooge's redemptive arc.
Honestly, me too. They're probably a national spelling bee champion too.
Yeah.
I love kids like that. Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh. Anywho.
Anyway.
I can't believe this is our final episode for the year.
I know. That's wild. Okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much. We hope you enjoyed this little dive into the making of The Muppet Christmas Carol.
Yes. And thank you for listening this year and supporting us in such a hard year for so many of us. It's been so wonderful to have this. Have this podcast and be able to share it with all of you. And we're looking forward to bringing you more in 2021.
Yes. And if you want to follow along during our break or just whenever, we're at Cartoons to Castles on Instagram and Cartoons Castles on Twitter. And then if you want to share our podcast with friends and family, the easiest way to do that is to share cartoonstocastles.com because we have all of our streaming service listed there.
And where can people find you if they want to connect with you, Jess?
Yes, you can find me at The Healthy Mouse on Instagram and Healthy_Mouse on Twitter. How about you?
And I am Keep Quirky on Instagram and Keep Quirky OC on Twitter. Thanks for listening.
Till next time,
keep dreaming.
It's true. Christmas. It feels like Christmas.